All right, thanks. All right, well, we're going to change topics again, this time going out into the outer solar system. And we're also going to change scales, but we're going to think about global ocean dynamics. So this is work I've done with Brittany Schmidt, Johannes Vicht, and Don Blankenship. And I first wanted to start off by kind of introducing the idea of ocean worlds across the solar system. So this is a schematic showing that there are actually quite a few ocean worlds outward of Jupiter. So for comparison, here is the Earth as a solid body, and then this is how much water in volume there is on the Earth. But if you look across the solar system, you can see for in the Jovian system, you have an ocean at Europa, you have an ocean within Callisto, and also on Ganymede. But if you look even further out in the solar system, there are global oceans on Enceladus and Dione and the Saturnian satellite Titan. If you go even further out to Neptune, you also are thought to have an ocean in its satellite Triton. And even further beyond that, there is an ocean inside Pluto as well. And the other thing to notice, besides that there is quite a lot of these bodies, is that they have quite a lot of water within them. So you can see that with respect to the total size of these bodies, they have quite a lot more water than the Earth does. And two of these bodies are going to be of particular interest for habitability. And these are Europa and Enceladus. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that it's thought that their oceans are in direct contact with a silicate mantle below and an ice shell above. This is important because they're embedded within the magnetic fields of Jupiter and Saturn, so their surfaces are going to produce oxidants due to this radiation. And then below that, because they're close enough into their host planets, that their interiors are thought to be heated by tides, so you could have a volcanically active seafloor within these bodies as well. And if you're able to have hydrothermal activity, you could have reductants formed within the seafloor. So life needs to have some chemical disequilibria to maintain life. So if you're able to have some type of mixing process that is able to get these oxidants in contact with the reductants, that makes a very habitable environment, in addition to there being the presence of water and the right composition to make the matter. So one thing that you can think about is how you could have materials from the seafloor reach the ice-ocean interface, and conversely, how you could have material from the surface reach to the ice-ocean interface and then get back down into the ocean. So it's a really dynamic problem. So one of the additional things you want to think about is their evidence of geologic activity within these worlds. So if you look at the surfaces, this is the surface of Europa and this is the surface of Enceladus. You can see that there's quite a lot of kind of active-looking geologic formations. You don't see many craters, which implies that it's a young surface. So there's potentially some type of relatively recent geologic activity going on them. So that's why Europa and Enceladus get quite a lot of attention when they think of habitability in the solar system. And towards this exchange process, which is fundamental to this redox reduction, you want to think about how heat and materials are transported across the oceans of these bodies. So this is what I think about, and I'm going to do three different kind of thrusts toward that end. I'm first going to look at theoretical predictions using kind of ideas that I know from the core dynamics community, because that's where I come from originally. Then we can use these ideas to help develop global numerical convection simulations to make a better understanding of what the dynamics could be going on, and we'll talk at the end towards implications for the ice-ocean interface and driving geologic activity in these bodies. So I wanted to start off with just a simple schematic showing how the planned form of convection can change with rotation. So a lot of times when you think of the Earth's ocean, you think that it's going to have lots of really strongly constrained rotation dynamics, but further out in the outer solar system, you have these bodies, but they're pretty far away from the host planet. They're tidally locked, so they're going to rotate much slower, so you need to think about how the variation is going to, or how the dynamics are going to change depending on the strength of the rotation influence. So here's a set of temperature perturbation plots from a recent paper by Thomas Gastine. This plot over here is going to be a non-rotating case. And so in this case, you can see that the interior fluid is largely isothermalized. You have really thin, narrow plumes that kind of form sheet-like structures that you can see across on the spherical surfaces. And if you move over to this next case, this is a more slowly rotating or a slowly rotating case. And you can see that it has pretty similar length scales compared to the non-rotating case, but it does have more variations within the bulk fluid. And you also can see that there tend to be some vorticity structures that now form towards the connective downlands. So you're starting to see a little bit more of the influence of rotation here. And as you have even more stronger rotational influence, you end up with this figure here, where outside of the tangent cylinder, which is the line kind of tangent to the mantle, you have more axial aligned flow structures. So that's where you're really starting to see rotation. But you can see that this axial nature kind of breaks down more towards the high latitudes. And if you increase rotation even further, you're going to have much more axial alignment. So you can kind of see how the dynamics change across that front. So they've actually carried out a really extensive numerical simulation data set where they use a rotating spherical shell. And they do more than 200 numerical models that look at different Ekman and Rayleigh numbers, so our rotation rates to thermal forcings. And their data is summarized in this figure here, and I'll kind of walk you through it. So they do a number of Rayleigh numbers, so that's going to be basically a description of your thermal forcing. And they also carry out a series of different Ekman numbers across here. So the Ekman number is going to basically be an inverse way of telling you how fast the rotation rate is. And then on the y-axis here is the Nusselt number telling you about the efficiency of thermal convection. So they find three regimes in their heat transfer study here. The first occurs right near the onset of convection, and here the Nusselt number increases rather slowly. It's about linear with the supercriticality of the system. And as you increase your thermal forcing, you end up getting a much steeper incline of your Nusselt-Rayleigh slope number. And in this case, you get a scaling that goes with Rayleigh to the 3/2. And this is consistent with an asymptotic rapidly rotating case where it's diffusivity free. And then in the final case that they find, they have this black line here. And this is the non-rotating scaling. So as you increase your thermal forcing enough, you're able to reach the non-rotating regime. And this they're using the Rayleigh to the 1/3 scaling exponent. So they're able to combine these different scaling regimes into a single diagram to show the different types of behaviors that they find. So on the x-axis, this is the Ekman number. So as you go towards this way, you have stronger rotational influence. Then they have the supercriticality on the y-axis. So as you might expect, they start off with their conductive regime, and then it has, for about 6 times supercritical, a weakly nonlinear regime. Then as you are able to go towards low Ekman numbers, you reach this rapidly rotating regime where you have that really strong axialized nature of the flow structures. On the other extreme, they're able to identify a non-rotating regime where even though they have rotation in their models, they aren't able to really see that characteristics in the models. And they have this kind of transitional regime that goes between these two n-member cases. So they're able to do some analysis in figuring out what can predict all of these different regime boundaries. This first one here comes from the intersection between the shallow scaling law, so that's the non-rotating case, and this Nusselt-Rayleigh to the 3/2 scaling law. So they're able to take that intersection to make a prediction that the non-rotating regime is going to occur when your Rayleigh goes as Ekman to the minus 12/7. So if you're greater within this regime, you expect rotation to not have much of an influence. And then conversely, this case down here where you're able to enter the rapidly rotating regime when the convective Rossby number of the thermal boundary layer is less than unity. So that's what defines this Ekman to the minus 8/5 law here. So to add perspective to this, I've added the three rotating convection cases that I showed previously onto this diagram, where the weakly constrained regime is in this data spot, and then the more moderately rotationally constrained case is here, and then once you approach the rapidly rotating regime, this is this more axialized case here as well. So this diagram is also particularly helpful because it allows us to extrapolate to ocean world conditions. So we're able to kind of extrapolate out and make predictions for where the ocean worlds in our solar system should lie in this regime diagram. So in order to do that, you need to have an estimate for the Ekman number, and you need to have an estimate for the Rayleigh number. And the Ekman number is relatively easy to estimate because it depends on the kinematic viscosity, the rotation rate, and the thickness of your ocean layer. So you're able to make estimates for those values with some ease, with the exception of the ice shelf thickness or the ocean thickness that has significant amount of uncertainty in it, but there's rough estimates for that. On the other hand, the Rayleigh number is much harder to estimate because you need to know things like the superadiabatic temperature contrast across it. But we can make some kind of rough estimates for that using these Nussel-Rayleigh scaling laws. So I'm able to use the two scaling laws for the Rayleigh to the 3/2 and the Rayleigh to the 1/3 and solve those to make an estimate of what the delta T is, considering I can make some measurements on what this heat flux is. Or not, well, I don't, but somebody has those estimates. So we're able to kind of get an n-member case of what the delta T temperature is going to be within these oceans to get an estimate for the Rayleigh numbers. So when I do this, I'm extending the axes here and plotting out for the best guess of the ocean thickness, where I think that four ocean worlds lie on this regime diagram. And here I just pick one ocean thickness, but I have a range of possible heat fluxes in here. So what you see is that all of them tend to be concentrated towards the upper end of the transitional convective regime. So that kind of implies that this diagram here is most likely going to be what the oceans of Enceladus, Titan, Europa, and Ganymede are going to be like. So now that we're kind of armed with this more theoretical prediction or hypothesis of what the convective dynamics could be doing, we can then set up a numerical convection model to make more detailed predictions for the dynamics. And in particular, the two things that I want to ask about are, how does the mantle influence the ocean? And then above that, how does the ocean influence the ice shell? So we do this using the numerical model MAGIC. And this is a code that started off as a solar dynamo code, and then it was evolved to study the geodynamo and also the interiors of giant planets. And I've applied it to the icy satellites as well. So it's a rather portable code. And it solves the Boussinesq thermal convection in a rotating spherical shell. But I do make some important simplifications that I don't include any of the ocean tides directly in the model. And I also don't include salinity contrasts. So this is a purely thermal case. And it's solved in non-dimensional units. And the governing equations are up there. So I a priori chose the input parameters to mirror where I think in the transition region where I think the icy satellite oceans are. So we're not able to actually simulate Ekman numbers this low, so I have to pick a more moderate Ekman number, and then I pick the Rayleigh number to kind of match it roughly with where I think it is in the parameter space. And it also uses a thin spherical shell geometry that's pretty similar to what we expect on the ocean worlds. That's a little bit too thick, but not too bad. And it assumes a Prandtl number of unity. So the other aspect that I look at is I'm carrying out three models, and they have different mantle heat flow patterns. And this is to look at the influence of what the mantle seafloor temperature is, because we don't have good constraints on that. So in the first case, I'm considering a uniform seafloor, and this is consistent with radiogenic heating within the mantle, which you would expect to be uniformly distributed. In the second case, which I'm calling the cold poles case, we have heating stronger at the equatorial regions, and this is consistent with the mantle being heated through obliquity tides. Then the third case is if instead the mantle is being heated by eccentricity tides, you would instead have hotter poles and a cooler equator relatively. So we're kind of comparing how the results are going to change depending on what the seafloor behavior is doing. So going through the results, I'll step through a bunch of the different dynamical properties, starting with the zonal currents. So these are averaged in time. And one thing to notice is that they all look really similar. So they're all generating a retrograde jet at low latitudes that is flanked on either side by prograde jets in the northern and southern hemispheres. And you can also see that there's not a lot of variation in the z direction in these models. And they have really similar velocities as well, where they're about 6,000 Reynolds numbers in peak flow. So we can also look at the upwelling. And here, this is also averaged in time to show a development of a really strong equatorial upwelling that's then compensated through downwellings on either side. So it kind of sets up an equatorial Hadley cell in all of these models as well. And you don't see a lot of variation in this case either in terms of what the mantle seafloor is doing. You do see a little bit of difference at high latitudes where the amplitudes are slightly higher in the hot poles case. But in general, the dynamics look really similar in the steady case. If you look at it instantaneously, you get a slightly different picture. One of the first things that I notice is that you no longer have this really strong equatorial band, but you still do have your strongest amplitudes in the equatorial region, and you are able to see some type of larger scale flow structures. But you can also see that the flow speeds are much more significant instantaneously than in the time average, which is what you would expect as well. So we reach Reynolds numbers of about 3,000. So moving on to the temperature field, here I'm showing cutouts of instantaneous temperature. So one thing to notice is that you have your plumes originating from the seafloor, and then they rise up towards the ice-ocean interface, but they are mixed within the fluid rather quickly, so you don't have the formation of a large laminar plume that goes all the way up from the seafloor to the ice-ocean interface, which is kind of a more traditional way of thinking about Europa's ocean that's been often talked about in the literature. So we're not seeing any evidence of that type of laminar flow structures in these models. And here again, you don't see a huge difference in terms of the dynamics, in terms of the flow the temperature structures across the different mantle scenarios in this case either, at least in the instantaneous aspect. But if you then look at your convective heat transfer, and this is the time average case, here I'm showing the heat transfer relative to the spherical average. So one is going to be kind of the average across that spherical surface. And in this is where you can really start to see some differences in how the mantle can influence the behaviors. So in all cases, you again see there's this really strong band of enhanced convective heat transfer at the equator, and that's largely due to this large steady radial upwelling that we saw. But if you look at high latitudes, this is where you can start to see that in the isothermal case, you have kind of an intermediate. When the poles are cold, you're going to have less heat transfer to the ice-ocean interface, where if your poles are hot, you're going to have more of that heat transfer to the ice-ocean interface. So you're able to see the pattern that is imposed along the seafloor all the way up to the ice-ocean interface. So you're able to transfer that. That's not erased through the ocean dynamic processes. So we want to look at this a little bit further because we can have heat transfer due to this large overwhelming circulation that's steady, and then you can also have turbulent heat transfer that's going on between the cases as well. So I'm going to walk you through all of the three cases, starting with the isothermal one. So here I'm showing the mean heat flux, and then here's where you can really see that large pulse of energy at the equator due to that large upwelling circulation. Then conversely, if you look at your turbulent heat flux, you can see that you also have more turbulent heat flux going on at the equator as well. So I show this kind of more quantitatively in this plot here, where it's the dimensionless heat flux as a function of latitude. The black is the total heat flux. The red is due to the mean heat flux component. And then the blue is the turbulence. So you can see that most of this big peak is due to the mean heat flux, but you can't really neglect what's going on with the turbulence, especially at high latitudes. So then considering the case with a hot equator, here you again see that you have the large peak in mean heat flux, a lot going on at the low latitudes through the turbulent heat transfer as well, but here you actually have a very, very small contribution at the poles due to turbulent heat transfer in this case. So that's even more apparent here where you still have your big heat flux at the equator, but then it also kind of decreases as you go towards the poles. And then conversely, in the hot poles case, here now you see the same pattern as before, except now you have an enhancement in turbulent heat transfer at the poles, which then reflects in your total heat transfer pattern, where you can now kind of see that there's almost three peaks in your heat transfer. So to summarize for the results from the global convection models, we're able to find that they have large, strong zonal flows that are organized into three bands. There's going to be a retrograde band at the equator and then two prograde bands at higher latitudes. And we also find that there's going to be a very small change in these flow patterns depending on what the mantle's doing. So it's really robust to characteristics of the mantle heat flow. Next, we look at the radial velocity, and here we see that there's this large upwelling circulation that forms an equatorial Halley-like cell, and that you're going to have downwelling on either side associated with that, and they're also not really strongly dependent on the mantle heat flow pattern. But if you look at the convective heat transfer, this is where you really need to be aware of what the mantle is doing. And in all of the cases, we did find that there was a strong peak in equatorial heat flux. But if the mantle is hotter at the poles, you're going to have that manifested at the ice-ocean interface. And conversely, if the mantle is cooler at the equator or at the poles, then you're going to have cooler ice-ocean interface there as well. So next, we can go on and think about boundary layer implications. So I'm going to talk about three things in particular, looking at how the heat flux along the ice-ocean interface can influence the thickness of your ice shell, and then how that can drive a material exchange between the ocean and the ice shell, and even that could potentially drive geologic activity that we could then potentially see on the surface to add as a constraint on the models. So again, here I'm just showing the three-dimensionless heat flux parameters for all of the three models I have. So I'm just going to consider the two N-member cases for the rest part of the talk, considering the cold poles where you're going to have less heat flux at the ice-ocean interface than in the hot poles case where you're going to have more heat flux at the ice-ocean interface. So if you have this extra amount of heat flux, then you could imagine that there's going to be regional melting going on in these regions. So if you're going to have regional melting, then you would expect there to be consequential variations in ice shell thickness. So in the case where you have cold poles, you're going to have more melting going on at the equator than at the poles, so you would expect that the ice shell to be relatively thin near the equator with thicker ice near the poles. Well, conversely, at the hot poles case, you'd still expect there to be relatively thin ice near the equator, but you could also have enhanced melting near the polar regions as well. So then you're going to basically have thicker ice right in your two mid-latitude regions instead. So if you're going to think about exchange mechanisms, you need to know or have an idea about how thick the ice shell is, because there is a lot of uncertainty in the community about how thick you, especially, well, all of them, but most often we think about Europa as how thick the ice shell is. So if you think about Europa, the estimates range from 1 kilometer to more than 30 kilometers. So if the ice shell is relatively thin and you have regions that are thinner, those would be more likely to have cracks or melt-through events in terms of getting ocean material up onto the surface. So that's one way that you could have exchange processes going on if the ice shell is thin. So then you could kind of look geographically of where you would expect there to be more evidence of geologic activity at the equator versus the equator end of the poles through cracks or melt-through. And if the ice shell has thickness variations, another thing you need to think about is how that thickness variation could be smoothed out. There's a couple ways that that could happen. It could happen through viscous relaxation, but it could also happen through the marine ice pump process, where you could have melting where the ice is relatively thick just due to its enhanced pressure. Then it's going to melt and the flow up gradient to where the ice shell is thinner, and then it's going to refreeze due to the change in melting point. So if you have this type of ice pump scenario, then you would expect there to be a variety, like a spatial heterogeneity in distributions of marine ice on Europa as well. So if you're able to have these regions of thin ice, they could potentially be refilled with accreted marine ice. And one aspect of marine ice is it rejects a lot of impurities. So you might expect there to be a different compositional signature of this accreted marine ice areas. So that's why I have two different colors in this schematic here, where if you have the cold poles case where you have thin ice here, you could have melting going on at high latitudes, which is then a flow and then refreeze to form regions with marine ice at the low latitudes. Or conversely, in the hot poles case, you would instead have refilling going on at both the poles and the equator. So you could have that type of spatial heterogeneity in these two scenarios. So if you have a thick ice shell and you have a difference in ice composition, this can have geodynamical consequences on what's going on in the ice shell. So if the ice shell is thick enough, it can also be unstable to convection. So it's thought that if you're going to have like a really cold surface and then you're going to have ice at the base that's at melting point, you're going to have enough buoyancy to drive convection. And if you instead also, or if you also have a compositional buoyancy source, then you're going to have even more likely to have these thermal compositional diapirs forming in regions where you have this marine ice component. So then you both have thermal and compositional buoyancy going on in these regions. So in this case, you would then expect there to be more diapirism wherever you have these regions with marine ice. So in the cold poles case, you'd only expect to see it at the equator, where instead if you have this hot poles, you'd expect it to see both equator and the poles. So those are kind of big picture ideas of how exchange processes could work. And I want to go through a example of Europa in particular, because I also work on the Europa Clipper mission, so I think about this, and that's what I know the best. So if you want to look at Europa's surface, which is what I'm showing here, there's a few features to note. One is the lack of craters, as I mentioned before. The only real obvious one is Pwll, located here. But you notice that there are lots of lineaments, and you can see features like this that are called chaos terrains. And we'll zoom in on a couple of these regions, and these are regions of disrupted ice. So you can see that in here that you have blocks that are kind of filled within a matrix. So it's really reminiscent of icebergs and melange floating on top of a water lens of some variety. So there's been a lot of argument saying that these are really active, or these recently active regions on Europa, where you could have had a lot of activity going on within the ice shell in these chaos terrains. And there's been a recent geologic map that's been produced for Europa. So here I'm showing the different geologic units. And the ones to notice are that these green areas are the chaos terrains. So you can see that there does generally seem to be more chaos terrains at the equator. And there's also chaos terrains up at both the North and South Pole. And there's also been some work looking at the composition of Europa's surface. And in this plot, I have superimposed this abundance of endogenic material, where regions that are red show more material that have arisen from deeper within the icy satellite. So that means potentially that that is ocean drive material that has made its way up to the surface. So if you toggle between these two, you can see that this coincides with the chaos terrain areas. So that implies that these chaos terrains do have an endogenic origin, which is consistent with the idea of there being a like a diapir or some type of melt-through or crack event that formed these features, which is consistent with the literature for how these features potentially form. So for these implications for Europa, there is we think that there's going to be this heterogeneous heating of the ice shell, where in all cases you're going to have more heat coming out at the equator, but there could also be an enhancement of heat coming out at the poles. And if the ice shell is thin, then you could have fractures and melt-through events occurring due to this enhancement in heat flow, or you could also have this diapir mechanism, and regardless of what the ice shell thickness is, these chaos terrains are consistent with this endogenic origin. And because you see these chaos terrains at both the equator and the high latitudes, it implies that you have this hot pole scenario where you have eccentricity heating of the mantle that is then reflected in the ice-ocean interface, then through geologic processes within the ice shell that manifest as surface features. And then I will just wrap up by saying that even though I talked about Europa primarily, this set of arguments I think should be applicable also to Ganymede, Enceladus, and Titan, where we did those scaling arguments at the beginning where they're predicted to be relatively weakly influenced by rotation. And in this regime, we find that there's three-dimensional turbulence, that we find three zonal jets with retrograde flow at the equator, and they have a large equatorial upwelling, and that you could have spatial variations in heat flow on the ice-ocean interface, and that that heat flow pattern is sensitive to what the mantle heat flow is doing, and that this type of heterogeneity can also have an influence on the ice-ocean interface, its properties, and how those even propagate upward towards the surface and being detectable that way. So, thanks.
So in terms of the title here, this is suggesting that all of these moons are could have life or could support life?
So I think some more so than others.
Which?
So I think Europa is one of the best cases for the reasons that I mentioned before, that you're going to have the ocean contact with the mantle and the ice shell. You have evidence for geologic activity, so you could have, you're more likely to have exchange between the surface, the ocean, and the mantle that can drive these redox reactions, and that happened relatively recently just because the surface age is relatively young. And it's a larger body, so it's most likely had its ocean for a long time, and life is thought to need, you know, a good amount. The more time you have in that type of environment, you're more likely to be more habitable. So I think that's one of the main reasons for Europa. And Enceladus follows very similar arguments, except it's a smaller body, so it's hard to argue that it's been around for as long in terms of the ocean.
So has anybody put a geochemical or biogeochemical model into these types of flows?
I wouldn't say they haven't put it together, but they have been considered separately. Yeah.
Thanks, Krista. So how confident are you, are they, in the measurements that the molecular makeup of the oceans, you know, you're pretty much saying it's water, but is that been constrained?
So I think they're pretty confident that it's water just because they have a kind of a expectation of what the material is in the solar system from, like, say, meteorites and kind of those types of models. So you know roughly how the material is going to vary with distance from the sun. So at that distance from the sun, there is a lot of water that would have consolidated to form the bodies. But what type of salts in that water is a very open question, and how much salt. So I think anything more than there's water is challenging to say more than that.
So you're pretty confident on the bounds, but you, you know, you place the planets on your parameter regime, you're pretty confident of those.
I don't say pretty confident, but because there's a lot of things that, like, for example, I only picked one ocean thickness. Yeah. But the ocean thickness is really poorly constrained. With all models, or all planet, or ocean worlds except for Enceladus. Enceladus, we have some new constraints from the Cassini mission. So there we're able to get measurements for the ice shell thickness there. But otherwise, like in Europa, the ocean could vary by tens of kilometers easily. So I think that that's one of the big uncertainties in putting them on this regime diagram.
Freezing ice exudes salts.
Right.
So what are the chances, imagining what the salts are, that this could be a salinity-driven convection system?
I think that's something that we definitely need to think about. It's possible because we don't really know what the salinity is. So I've taken the approach of starting simple and ignoring salts for now, but that's something that I think definitely needs to be talked about. And I know that some people at Caltech work on that. And hopefully we can do more on that front, because I think that's something that needs to be worked on, because that's a big missing aspect of these models so far.
So the numerical models were all at relatively large Ekman number, which I assume is just because you have to turn up your subgrid viscosity. So it's
right,
playing the role essentially of a turbulent viscosity.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder, when you place these observed ocean worlds on that chart, how we should be thinking about where they should fall on that, if really it'll be a turbulent viscosity that will matter rather than some sort of molecular.
So in the, let me just go back to that plot, I think that'll help. So when I did these estimates here, I assumed molecular values. And since I don't know what I should use for turbulent values, if someone has a good idea, I'd be super keen to know. I could place them using those estimates. But I think using the molecular is the right thing to do, at least for the satellites themselves for here. But for the models, we're pretty limited to using really high values of viscosity. And there's not much you can really do to get around that, but do the best we can.
So looking at the maps of the ice fields, there seem to be some pretty significant zonal variations, whereas mm-hmm. in your simulations, it's pretty zonally symmetric in the average. So can you comment on that discrepancy and what might be causing those zonal variations?
Yeah, let me go back to that graph. So these regions correspond to you're going to have longitudinal variations, primarily thought to be due primarily to the tidal heating, because as the bodies go around Jupiter, they're not, or Saturn, you're not influenced uniformly with longitude. So some regions are going to have thinner ice or thicker ice just because you have that extra dissipation. So in these are regions where you're expected to have relatively thin ice due to that tidal heating, where this is you're going to have thicker ice. So that's actually consistent with this idea that where you have thinning of your ice, you could have this accretion of marine ice that then can help drive this diapir mechanism or forming the chaos terrains. So that's consistent with that idea, but that's probably due to icial thickness variations due to tidal heating differences.
But if you go to the previous,
this one.
There's this very sharp transition about three quarters of the way across.
Here you
mean? Yeah.
And that's due to differences in spatial resolution. So, yeah. So we only have like two strips that are in high resolution for Europa from the Galileo spacecraft.
I thought that was really interesting.
It would be.
I was wondering about the zonal flows that you expect in this regime. Do you think that, have you looked at whether or not you could pick that up in an induced magnetic field signal?
So the zonal components I'm a little bit more skeptical about, just because you're going to have shearing and probably create a toroidal magnetic field. But I thought a little bit about what signal you could get from the overturning circulations. And if you do some really simple scaling arguments that follow Rob Tyler's work, I predict that you should be able to get a 3 nanotesla signature due to these types of global overturning circulations. So that's pretty challenging for the upcoming Europa Clipper mission, but we're hopefully going to do better models of this to get a more precise estimate and how that could vary along the different spacecraft trajectories to see if we might be able to make some constraints on that. Because, yeah, that would be a really valuable way if we're able to generate strong enough magnetic fields to do it.
Great talk. I would like to ask you a question, how much you're confident in the estimate of Rayleigh number? For example, could there be a possibility to cross in another regime of convection, Kragman regime, where the turbulent boundary layers become turbulent?
So I would not say I'm super confident in the Rayleigh numbers. I mean, Rayleigh numbers are notoriously hard to estimate, and I just basically use the two scaling law M members to try to figure out what equation I should use, and then the numbers that I put into it for, say, ice shell thickness, are I just use the one value. So I think that there is some uncertainty, considerable uncertainty on those Rayleigh number estimates. So I think you could move in those diagrams. I wouldn't say like a huge amount, but a non-trivial amount, I think. Yeah.
A naive question.
Sure.
I didn't see Prandtl number in your, is it buried in there somewhere? When we do DNS of penetrated, of just regular old convection,
right,
it's really dependent on whether it's salt water, whatever. Anyways, just comment.
Sure. So in the models that I showed today, I have a Prandtl number of unity, just kind of assuming that the eddy values will make it so they're comparable, the two. But I've been doing some cases that have higher Prandtl numbers, and it doesn't seem to have a huge effect if you assume the same thermal forcing. So if you consider the same convective Rossby number for a different Prandtl number, I don't see huge differences in the dynamics. Because once you get into that really strongly forced regime where you don't have a lot of rotational influence, it seems like you still get, say, this 3Z zonal wind, you still get this big pulse in equatorial heat flow, you still get the similar pattern in convective heat flow. So I don't see a huge change depending on what Prandtl number I've been using, but that's still really preliminary.
Yeah, we just, for instance, in that simple DNS problem, the entrainment rate is really sensitive to Prandtl number, and so sorting it out. Anyways, I was just curious, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's definitely something I've been thinking about.
While they're going over there. So do you have any sense whether there's any exchange of fluid between the mantle? I mean, it's whether you get cold, like seeps or anything like that, where you're, I mean, so the salts would come through that kind of process, but also you might have more efficient channels driving, you know, particular plumes or something like that.
So for Enceladus, there was a recent paper that looked at heat flow in the mantle, and they do find that they have really concentrated regions of enhanced heat flux, and that's something that I haven't considered in the models, but should do so in the future, because it really is concentrated kind of in fissures along the seafloor. So that's something that needs to be thought about as well. And I don't know of any models for Europa, but they've also done some recent work on Ganymede, where Ganymede's pretty interesting because you have your outer layer of ice shell, then you have a global ocean, but then below that you have another layer of ice that's denser, so it's ice 2. And then there's the mantle. But this region of ice 2 can also convect and provide a way of transporting fluids, if there was any, in the mantle through that ice layer up into the ocean. And that seems to suggest that there might be some type of channelization on Ganymede as well.
So it looks like you sort of, for simplest assumptions, you assume alpha is constant, a linear equation of state, and just in a terrestrial 2 kilometer deep ocean, you can double that. And I'm not sure I quite understood how deep these oceans are, but it seems like you could move quite a ways on your log plot even with, 10 times the alpha. I don't know if you can keep on going up with that. Have you any idea of that sensitivity?
In the numerical models, I haven't looked at anything like that. In terms of the scaling arguments, in terms of where the ocean worlds fall on that convective supercriticality Ekman plot, I haven't noticed a really strong difference depending on what alpha I've used. I've changed it by at least an order of magnitude, and it didn't change significantly. Just because of the exponents, it doesn't have as huge of effect as you might imagine, but the dynamics themselves could potentially be impacted. Like, there's a paper a number of years ago that talked about the potential for a stably stratified stratosphere at the top of the ocean, just because that's where you're going to have the negative alpha. So that's been talked about in the context of ocean rolls as well. So that's not something I have included here. It's a pretty simple equation of state, as you noted.
But. Great. Let's thank Chris again.